All right. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. The last thing I want to do this afternoon is to give you a course in biology. It's not necessary because the way I got into learning about ivory and bone and horn and related materials is very simple. My background is 36 years at the American Museum of Natural History, and when I went there as a young man, I had no idea at all about, never mind the Endangered Species Act and CITES and all of that business. I didn't know that existed. My interest was in learning the collections. I was a collections person, a curatorial assistant, what they called us then. And the first thing that I learned, I started looking at materials. And a lot of the curators and a lot of the old timers there were very knowledgeable, of course, in their field, and they were experts in their field, and they were teaching me the ropes. They were teaching me things. It wasn't long after that that I learned that a lot of the stuff that I was learning was wrong. And what happens a lot of the time when you learn something, you regurgitate what you learn. You go out and you want to use it, you want to show people that you know what you know, and most of the time it's a big mistake. And I quickly learned by picking up the pieces, and this is what you're going to do. This is what I want to show you. When it comes to ivory and bone and horn and related materials, I don't want to talk about microscopic structure, and I don't want to talk about, you know, elliptical structures and rosette structures and the Haversian systems and stuff like that. There's no need for that because you'll never use it. I use it because I need to use it. However, when I began my studies, the first thing I learned was that I would pick up an artifact at the Museum of Natural History. My background is with the anthropology department, and I worked with the African collections, the South American, the Asian collections, the whole world. I was throughout the entire world. And I was working with a lot of material. And when I'm looking at the stuff, and I have a curator or some other person explaining to me what I'm looking at and what this is, I go home and I start thinking about these things, and I'm thinking to myself, that doesn't make sense. What that guy said doesn't jive with what I'm looking at. So I started looking, of course, at biology books and things like that. And I quickly learned that a lot of people were wrong. And how I corrected that was very simple, and this is what I want to share with you. You look at things, your eyes are the most important things you're going to have. And I don't know how many people deal in ivory, but as Michael said, it's just not elephant ivory. You know, ivory is walrus and narwhals and hippopotamus and pigs and things like that. People make objects out of these. They've been making objects out of these things for thousands of years, and they've shown up in museums and in auction houses and in museums very much like yours. And if you notice, the first thing that you see when you look at a piece of ivory like this, you notice that it's not a simple piece of material. It's not simple at all. It's very complex, very complex. It's a tooth with tissues and tissues that make it strong and tissues that make it elastic and tissues that make it grow. And these things all have functions in them, but they're of no use to you, really. Not in the sense of what your curatorial duties are and how you're going to be, very important word, how you're going to be in compliance with the law. That's what we need. That's what we're here about. This is why we're here. Compliance with the law. And if you look at this piece here, you notice that there's a pattern there. Okay? And I don't want to use any fancy words, but these are called Schrager, for Schrager patterns. And that's can you be used to your advantage. How many people you do have access to ivories in your collection? Show of hands. Wow, a lot. Well, My advice to you, when you go to your collections, and I don't know how many of you live with your collections. I lived with my collections at the museum. I'm always within the collections. A lot of people are outside of the collections, and they do a lot of administrative stuff. I don't. And I always sat with a figure or a raw piece of material, and I looked at it. Very simple. You look at it, and you take notes, maybe, and you take mental notes, and you get diagrams, and maybe even diagram things yourself. And you come up with things like this, for example. This, we were talking about, I just mentioned that it's just not elephant ivory, but it's also hippopotamus and whales and things. But when it comes to elephants, we also have the extinct, like mammoth and mastodons, and the extinct, which are the Asian, right now, the Asian elephants and the African elephants. The question that and the point that Michael just made about determining species, it's not easy to determine, for example, the African elephant species from the Asian elephant species. It can be done, but it's not a practical thing. It can be done statistically, but it's not practical because you have to cut up the piece. And you can't go around cutting up your collection, so that doesn't work. But if you notice, I'll show you a very simple technique here. If ever you pick up a piece of ivory in your collection and you see this pattern, that's ivory. Whether it's elephant ivory or mammoth ivory, you can figure that out yourself later. But as soon as you see this pattern, this herringbone pattern, that is proof that what you're dealing with is Proboscidea, in other words, the elephant family. Another thing here is that when you have this pattern, you notice that these lines intersect, and when they intersect, you can measure those angles. Those are measurable angles. That's an advantage to you. And there's a little general rule. If the angle that you measure on here on the right side, you have a sample of African elephant, and if you notice that the angle here is somewhat obtuse. In other words, it's greater than 90 degrees. And over here, it's pretty closed. It's 90 degrees or less, usually around 45 degrees. When you have a closed angles like this, you probably have mastodon on your hands or on extinct species. And that's important because the law deals with and addresses that. And you have to prove, or you have to show, for both legal and practical reasons, that you have a mammoth or African or an Asian elephant on your hands. Moving forward, you should also look at broken pieces. Sometimes, you see, you have a tusk, and we all know what an elephant tusk looks like. You know, you all seen elephants. But things change when an elephant tusk is carved into a figure. Or, I don't know, you've seen pool balls and elephant keys, piano keys. And it changes. Things happen. It just doesn't look the same anymore. So what do? Fortunately, this structure is natural and in the material. Those are tubules inside the matrix, inside the dentine of the tusk. You can't erase them. You can't stain them out. You can't sandpaper them out. There's nothing you could do to eliminate them. They're there forever. And that's good, because that's your key. If you go further and you break open a tusk, for example, you have these, you see these like shelves? These look like little terraces. Those are actually, that's actually this. except this is polished. And these, again, are called trigger lines. Now, if you look at a finished product, these are beads, circle beads of elephant ivory. If you go ahead, you see? That's the trigger lines you're looking at in the close-up. You can't erase them. You'll always see them there. So if you have a statue, for example, and you want to determine whether it's ivory at all, elephant ivory, look for that. If you have that, you can determine that it's elephant. Your question, your next question, is, well, I don't know if it's elephant, if it's a modern elephant or a mammoth. Well, call me or somebody in your institution that might have a background in knowing that kind of thing. Also, an interesting comment that Mike made was the information that you have to offer when it comes to providing information about elephants and as it relates to the Endangered Species Act. Well, whatever your information is in your archives may be competent information. It might be incompetent. So you got to be very careful the information that you have. I can't tell you how often I have found information in the archives of the American Museum of Natural History is totally, totally, totally wrong. And it's not a reflection in the institution. That's the information that came with the material. As we move forward, let's skip that. This, again, that's the structural innards. Sorry about that. You see, here's another view of the same thing. You can see the lines, the Schrager lines. Now we go to a hippopotamus, for example. By the way, ivories either have, most all ivories have dentine, but all ivories do not have what we call and know as enamel. And that's very important because, again, here's a raw tusk, canine rather, of a hippopotamus. On the surface of the tooth is a very hard layer of enamel. And that's a very interesting piece of tooth there that you'll find. I mean, you know, you look at that and generally when you become familiar with the structure of tooth in general, you'll know that that's a hippo. But again, you can have problems. You can have problems like this. When you open it up, the inside can look very much like the elephant ivory. So there, you're facing a problem. This is where this expert again comes in. This is where you have to, what I like to tell people, don't try this at home. Because it gets to a point where you need to stop. One of the things that you really need to understand is that what do things look like in general? This is why I don't want to turn this into a biology lesson and talk about complicated structures and things like that. This is as far as we're going to get in terms of structures. Again, if you were to look at a hippo tooth like this, and I'm telling you, I'm inviting you to go back to your collections and find them. Find hippo teeth. Find elephant tusks. Find pig tusks, find antlers and things, and learn what they look like on site. We say, oh yeah, that's, let it become a routine of yours. Oh yeah, that's a hippo tooth. Yeah, that's an elephant tusk. Yeah, that's a piece of antler, as opposed to a horn, for example. Two different things, horn and antlers, two totally different things. You'd be surprised how many people don't know that. Here's the front of the tooth. By the way, let me go back here. See this whole part here? That entire part is embedded inside the jaw of the animal. Just that brown part is what you see out of its mouth. And here is the surface of the hippo, and that's cementum, which is another tissue that's there, and that bonds the tooth itself to the jaw. And that is the tip of the tooth. And here's the microscopic, sort of a, not a microscopic, but a more of an enlarged surface of the tooth. of the enamel surface. And again, you take something like this, for example. Let me see if I have it here. This is a very great investment. A loop. This loop is wonderful. Amazon, I don't know, $6 or $7, and has a light, it has a UV light, and it's really great. And you don't, you know, it has a magnification of 10 to 20 times. You don't want to go too high because otherwise you magnify your stuff out of scope. But that is also the surface of the tooth of a hippo. Now, I don't know how many of you are interested in this kind of thing. One of the dangers of getting too involved in lecturing about this thing, that it's boring. And I mean, who wants to know about the surface of a tooth? I mean, you know, I mean, I can't even find my own friends who you know, I mean, I'm in the closet about this. I, you know, it's frustrating. You know, I mean, I paid them to let me help talk to you. So again, here you have the surface, the inside surface of the hippo. Now, I took this for different reasons other than showing it to an audience. because when I was first presenting these things, we were getting a little more technical. But I think as technical as I want you to be is what your eyes, let your eyes talk. Let the piece talk to you. Whether you invent your own nomenclature, whether you invent your own vocabulary, you do what you're comfortable with. Because if the ultimate goal for you is to present this to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and say, hey, this is a hippo, this is an elephant, and they got to say, okay, we'll accept that, or we don't accept that. And if they don't accept that, well, then you're on the hook to prove it, to show it, to explain it, and you have to. Here again, this is the internal structure, this is the enamel, and if you were to magnify this stuff under a microscope 100 times, 200 times, 300 times, it gets really, really interesting. But it's not within the scope of this talk. Here's another thing that's very interesting. We talked about that. We're not only talking about elephants, but we're talking about also whales. And we're talking about hippopotamus. Here's a whale's tooth. Whales, they're really varied. They come in a lot of shapes and sizes. Most whale teeth are one, what they call monodont. That means that they shape only they one. You've seen one tooth, you've seen them all. And but they're also very interesting. In fact, here's the tooth that looks very, very unremarkable on the outside, but when you crack it open, here's two of them that are compared next to each other, and they look pretty much the same, but they have different colors for different reasons. And some of them have been bleached because they've been out in the sun, and others have been protected for other reasons. But here, crack that tooth open. This is what you find. It's full of these, what they call osteodentine, and they're very pretty, actually. And again, these can be used as diagnostic features. When you're looking at a statue, when you're looking at a figure, when you're looking at a tool, when you're looking at an artifact, that you may think, oh, this may be from a whaling context, or it might be from Alaska or something like that, or a maritime context. You look for that kind of thing. And here's a close-up, and at the end of the edge of the tooth, it's cementum that I was mentioning when we were talking about the hippopotamus. But again, you see, as minimal as I'm trying to be, it can be very confusing. And I think if anything you should bring away from this is to go back into your collections and gather whatever you can, especially if you have whole pieces, whole tusks, whole teeth, and you can sit down with them and just spend, or keep them on your desk for months and months and months and look at them. You know, you'll be surprised, but a lot of the osteology and a lot of the anatomy that I've learned, especially on birds, is eating animals, you know, being chicken and stuff like that, and you learn the anatomy that way. I mean, my family thinks I'm a wacko, but, you know, that's a different story. So, And then when you look at bone and ivory, they're totally, totally different looking things. You know, you have systems there, you have Haversian systems, you have canals, you have capillaries, capillary canals and things like that. Very pitted, they're wide open. You have spongy bone, you have what they call osteotic bone and lamellar bone. And they're very diagnostic, but you can leave that to the expert and you know, you don't need to get into that because, but you do need to be able to identify and separate, for example, a bone from a piece of ivory. And by the way, when it comes to horns, you know, horns are made out of keratin, the same thing that hair and your fingernails are made out of. And antlers, for example, are made out of bone. And horns never branch, except in the antelope. And antlers always branch, and that's just a basic difference. Again, here's just a close-up. Thank you.